This is an interview with Rebecca Forsyth of Greenup, Kentucky. This interview was conducted by Edward McCurley for the Kentucky Oral History Commission at Ms. Forsyth's home in Greenup on July 26, 1978. I'd like to know what your full name is.
Well, my name is Rebecca Biggs Forsyth.
Where were you born?
I was born at Frost, Kentucky, in Greenup County. It was rural post office, Frost, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Farming country, farming.
Now, I'll ask this one cautiously. Do you mind telling me what year?
1895, August the 18th.
August 18th, 1895. And how did you come to live in Greenup?
Well, I married the first time, and my husband died after we were married 4 years. And I went to business school. I had never attended school in my life before, and I went to business school and came to Greenup to work for the county attorney.
I see.
In March 1926, and I've been here ever since.
How long did you work for the county attorney?
Oh, I think a year, and from there, the First National Bank hired me, and I was only there about 6 months. And the county clerk needed a clerk, so he sent for me, and I went there because I liked the work better than the bank work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there 6 years and a half. And after that, I became postmaster, and I was postmaster of Greenup for 20 years. And I retired at 20 years and went to my husband's garage. He had the Dodge Agency in Greenup. And I was there 13 years as a bookkeeper.
Now, I've heard that you have heard some stories about the Civil War tales. Can you tell me some of those?
Well, you probably, my great-grandfather, William Biggs, he came to Greenup County when he was 12, in 1812, and in some way he accumulated quite a bit of property and a number of the black people, and he lived below town. He had a spread there of 900 acres, and he had quite a bit of property over the county. And of course, he was a Southern sympathizer, although his sons didn't fight. But we had at that time an association that was called the Home Guards.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably heard of them. And they were supposed to keep order. And they seemed to be rather self-appointed. And they called themselves a protective order, but I don't know who they were supposed to protect. But because they appropriated things that were not theirs. As for instance, my uncle, a great uncle, had drove of young mules, and he lived in a rural community where I was raised. And in his words, he said, along about dark, Squire Holiday Waring sent a black boy down to tell me that he saw my mules being driven up the road by a bunch of those home guards. So he says, I took the black boy and my pistol and got on my horse and went up to follow them. And I found them in a stable lot about Siloam. And he says the men had gone up to the house on the hill. The house is still standing there, by the way. And he said, I said to the boy, open that gate. He says he opened the gate and rode in, and he says the mules came out of there, and of course they broke for home. And I went with them. I said, Uncle Jimmy, what would you have done if those men had come back down the hill? He says, I expect I'd have shot some of the rascals. And he took the mules back and took them away from the road and kept them in a barn.
Mm-hmm.
And got through the war with them. They would have sold them to the Union Army, you know. Then another time, my great-grandfather was in his barn lot one evening, and this same crew came along and came in to see him and announced they wanted feed for their horses. And they were hunting a place to stay all night. They wanted feed for their horses. And he said, I hadn't any corn to give you. And they told him they'd take it. So he stepped out and called the colored man that was his special servant. He said, Harrison, bring my gun. And the boy brought him his gun, and he sat down on the step of the corn crib, and he says, now I'll shoot the first damn man that steps forward. And they decided the horses were not so hungry, and they all left. Now that's the kind of people that we had. I don't think of anything else that's connected with the war.
Well, they didn't have any difficulty being Southern sympathizers this far north in Kentucky.
Yes. One of my mother's aunt's husband, they went to Old Town. He was keeping a store there. And I think they must have been rather prominent Southerners, because they were prominent people and rather took, and later on, what I mean is, they, two of the sons became sheriffs and they were politicians in the county.
Mm-hmm.
That they took the father, for what reason I never knew, and picked up another old man who was like, sort of like the Wallop man. They took them, I don't know where they took them. They took them, put them in prison, wherever the closest prison would have been,
mm-hmm.
and kept them for months and months. And Uncle Will Wallach had a wife and several small children, and she kept, she had a store, and she kept her children and her family together and ran the store till he came home. And but the worst part of it was, the Union officers took their good horses away from them and rode them and made them walk.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I've heard that all of my life. So, I'm Southern sympathizer myself, although now I realize it was a very impractical idea.
Well, how did the end of the war affect your family? They probably stood to lose a lot, didn't they?
Well, they lost the Negroes, you know that. And of course they were valuable, the same as any other stock. But I have been told that my great-grandfather was very broad-minded. He never separated the families of his colored people. And he had one man, this man that bought him the gun, was his, he bought him as a little boy in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and brought him home on his horse. And he always just thought the world and all of that man. And the man ran away. You see, they all just got in a boat and crossed the river into Ohio, free country.
Mm-hmm.
And Uncle Harrison went with him. And he had made his will. My great-grandfather had made a will and left Harrison a small farm. Said that he had, where he had enough to land to keep him and to till and to keep whatever stock he needed and all. Well, of course, he was so infuriated when he left that he changed his will.
Mm-hmm.
So years afterwards, Uncle Harrison wrote to my grandfather, William Biggs, and said that he was down and out. They had no education, whatever. There was no provision for those people. They were, all they could do was work, like a horse. And Grandpa told him to come on back, and he had a what had been a slave cabin in the yard, and he fixed it up, and Uncle Harrison lived there till he died, and he buried him and all. And that was the story of Uncle Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, my great-grandfather, I never understood, he was a man ahead of his generation. He made money, and in 1874 he built the Biggs House, a hotel in Portsmouth, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and it burned. And in 76 he built it back. It burned in 76 and he built it right back. And it was quite an occasion, and it was written up in the paper. They had a big ball and everything of the kind, you know. And now that was one piece of property. He had property in Huntington, and he had, I don't know how many farms in Greenup County, as I said. It hurt him, you know, because he was a man who, well, and he had a wood yard that furnished wood for the steamboats.
Mm-hmm.
He had a wharf at his place, his farm below town, and he furnished wood for steamboats. Of course, he had colored people to get it for him, and he had wood on his own property. And he had so many things going for him that he would die a rich man.
Do you remember any of the steamboat days? Were they still going out here when you were growing up?
Yes. Yes. In fact, my father used to ship the cattle to Cincinnati. See, I lived on this farm down about 15 miles west of here.
Mm-hmm.
And they shipped, I've seen him load cows and calves on the steamboat that would come in. And, you know, if the water was high, they could have a ramp or that they let down. Yes, there was a great deal of shipping went on at that time, and then, of course, it gradually. But I never was on a boat.
You never were?
I never, and my mother and all of my father's people, they rode the boats and talked about all the grandeur of the food and everything they had at that time. You know, they had such fine ballrooms and all, and had such, they were so extravagant in their decoration and all, but I never was on one. I just got here too late.
Mm-hmm.
By the 1890s, that was beginning to, you see, I think the 70s, 60s, 70s, and long there was the heyday of the boats.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard you're familiar with the E.K. Railroad.
Well, no, I'm not. I don't know anything about the E.K. Railroad more than anyone else does. And more, there's more in Mama and my mother's book than about anything else.
I see.
I think I rode on it once. But that was the only... I went to Grayson one time. They were having some sort of a celebration out there. I rode from here. Out there. But that was beginning to be a thing of the past, too. You know, after the roads were built and automobiles came in, it didn't take long for those things to go out of. Now, the man who came here and built the railroad and his son married my father's first cousin, but that's all I can say about him. I knew them and all.
Miss Griffith suggested that I might mention to you the time that the railroad depot burned. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember.
Tell me about that.
I don't think I'd bother to keep up some of the things I told her. You know, I go down there and they begin asking me questions about things that happened. And I tell them things that if there's nobody in there. But, all I know is that I was visiting here, visiting my cousin, and fire whistle blew and everybody went to the fire. It was quite an occasion in those days. They had a manned pumper. They didn't, you know, men took it.
Mm-hmm.
And they, everybody went to the fire. And of course they had quite a time with their little fire engine, and the depot burned down. And one of the men came out with his, he had on his trousers and pajama jacket, he had squat, who he was a very prominent person, the banker here in town, with his hat squashed down over his head. And everybody had, I think it had a little snort. And when we were returning from the fire, we had our banker, Mr. Ed Pollock. He was a very dignified gentleman. He's president of the bank here. And he was the head of the Masons, and he was just one of the best citizens, you know, most prominent citizens. So when my cousin and I came in through town, we saw this man patrolling the bank. He was peering around in the windows and doors, and well, it scared us. We started to go back the way we came, and then we finally recognized him. It was Mr. Pollock, the president of the bank. He had a bandana handkerchief tied around his throat, and he had his hat squashed down on his head, and he was carrying a gun about that long in his hand. And my cousin said, "Is that you, Mr. Pollock?" He said, "Yes, this would be an excellent time to break in the bank, and I was just guarding the bank." He said, "I thought maybe they might have set fire to the depot to draw us away from town." And it was so ridiculous, you know, that we thought it was it was quite an occasion to see him, because he was always dressed just so. Very neat looking man and very dignified. And then when we got back home and got in bed, the fire whistle blew again. And there was an empty house out by the railroad caught fire. I presume it was the people who burned the depot. I think the idea was robbery. They thought there was something in there, you know. We had a wholesale grocery company here.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that they thought there were valuables in the storage there in the depot. And then we just supposed they'd probably stayed in this house and maybe covered their tracks by burning it or something. I don't know. Anyhow, it seemed too much of a coincidence that there was no connection. So then it burned, and we went to that fire. And by that time, everybody was celebrating. And we all came in, Judge Sowers was one of them. We all came in to greet it by that time, and prevailed upon one man to open a little confectionery that he had, and we all had, about 4 o'clock in the morning, we were all sitting around celebrating it. And I said, when we went home, a pleasant time was had by all. Well, you see, we didn't have very much to amuse us. But it was ridiculous, the thing that happened. Mr. Pollock, as I say, was a very dignified man, and he was the sort of a man that we sort of stood in awe of.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me something one time that I thought was so funny that I used it as a joke. He went to French Lick. He used to go to French Lick every now and then, put up at one of those big hotels, and you know, they were supposed to be very grand. So Mr. Pollock wrote a miserable hand. It was just, well, it was just a series of curlicues. And he wrote his order. And the colored man came in and said, he looked at it a little while, and then Mr. Pollock said, he sauntered over and he said, "Boss, I don't quite understand this item." Mr. Pollock told him what it was, and he said, "Oh, yes. And he went back a little while, and he came back and he said, "Boss, this item right here, I didn't quite understand that." He went on till he went through the menu, and then Mr. Pollock caught on. He said, "Well, you know, I'm sorry that my writing is so poor, He said, "That's all right, boss. I've known smart people couldn't write no better than you can." And knowing Mr. Pollock, I thought of it, it struck me as being so funny.
What year was that depot fire and the night that you caught him dressed strangely?
Let me see. I think that Dorothy, I was telling her grandfather was here at that time, and I believe she said it was 1912 or 13. About that time, I'm not sure. I'd say about 1912.
You said you didn't have much to amuse yourselves, and so you were being amused by the fire that night. How generally did you amuse yourselves? What did you do in your spare time?
Well, that was the era, you know, of the boys all wore their white pants in the evening and their straw boaters, and they went around to the houses, and maybe they'd bring their guitar, and we all sat on the porch and sang. Of course, I know you don't remember anything like that.
I never did that.
But that, and once in a while, we'd have a picnic. There was, before they put this last dam in, there was a beautiful falls out on Sandy, just a little piece from here. And we went out there on picnics and swam and whatever. Then there was a place at Argolite. They had a falls out there, and there was a rock promontory that we could picnic on, and once in a while they had a dance. But it wasn't exciting. Automobiles were just coming in at that time when I was growing up. You see, we had no roads.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a little bit late in getting to Greenup County because they soon shook them to pieces. So there was very little. I didn't live here. Everybody in Greenup is kin to me. Is that thing?
It's on.
Well, I hope you'll delete some of the goofy gossip. Because this cousin that I was so fond of, her mother was my mother's sister and her father was my father's first cousin. There was another girl that I was very fond of, and her father was my mother's first cousin and her mother was my father's first cousin. there was every other family in Greenup practically was kin to us. Mm-hmm. On one side, on my mother's side and my father's side. And of course, we visited a bit, a good bit around. I don't know that we did anything. It was exciting. Young people today wouldn't think so. Of course, we slipped around and smoked cigarettes occasionally. Took a little sip of moonshine when we could get it, and maybe a little beer, and felt real devilish. But it was very tame.
When were you married? What year?
Well, I was married the first time in 1920. And the second time I was married in 1931. Monday was my 47th anniversary for my second husband.
I was wondering, what was the proper way to go about what we call dating in 1920?
In 1920, it was according to whether your parents, you know, we had a sort of a caste system at that time, and hardly anybody was good enough for your daughter to marry. And only an occasional young man whose family was outstanding in goods and family characteristics and all that sort of thing. Their genealogy was prominent. Of course, they were a catch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But ordinarily, the young men were not considered as eligible for your daughters to marry. So I had quite a time achieving my first marriage, but I made it. I finally just picked up my clothes and walked out and announced that we were to be married at such and such a time, and we did. Then, of course, the last time I married, I was working here, and my husband's working here. He was a cost engineer on the CNO, and I was working a deputy clerk in the clerk's office. And I just went on with my work thing. We never had a family. We led a very tame existence. Nothing spectacular happened especially, only the 37 flood was 2.5 feet in the house here, upstairs. And there was only 12 houses in Greenup that it wasn't in. And we had to plaster the entire downstairs and put new doors and windows and everything of the sort in the house. And we never thought of asking the government for help. Isn't that strange? It never occurred to us.
This is side two of an interview with Rebecca Forsyth of Greenup, Kentucky.
Well, I thought that now we had, the house had to be wired, rewired. The whole downstairs was plastered, papered, painted, new woodwork put in, and well, I just couldn't tell you the things we did. And I went right on and paid it and thought nothing of it. And we were, at that time, the salary in the post office was very small. And you can imagine that Mr. Price's salary wasn't too big at that time, you know. And of course we couldn't buy anything we wanted, especially at that time. I've had great periods of austerity in my lifetime, but I never thought of asking the government for to do anything for me, and I just don't understand it. But if it keeps up, I'm afraid that there'll be a breaking point.
How did you come to be postmaster here? The reason I ask that is during the time that you had that position, it seems to me that there probably weren't that many women around the country who held this thing.
Fred Vinson, yes, that's new then. Fred Vinson sponsored me. Mr. Bates was a protege of Fred Vinson. And Mr. Bates wanted, you know, he favored my having it. And Mr. Vinson, I went to Mr. Vinson's office. I said, Mr. Vinson, I never went to school a day in my life. I'll never pass a civil service examination. And he says, well, you'll have to if you get the post office. He says, now look here, Rebecca. He says, I'm putting you up for it. And he said, it's up to you to make the highest grade. You know, he didn't, you don't remember, do you,
no.
Fred Vinson? Well, he was quite a character. He just told you what he thought. And I made second highest. The only thing that there was one man made a higher grade, but he had more experience than I, more business experience. And I, next to that, I made the second highest grade, and there were about 11 took the examination. I don't know how I did it. There was an angel sitting on my shoulder.
You said you'd never gone to school?
I was, you see, we lived down in this farming community, and at that time, the schools were not very good. We had a very short school year. So I think it was 6 months, or it was probably 5 or 6 months. And we didn't have very high grade teachers. But my mother was a teacher. And my mother was for her time and age and experience with a, what I would call an intellectual person. She's never interested in the work of, you know, like most farm wives. She could do, she did, and she was adequate in raising her family and doing what she had to do, but her interest wasn't in it.
Mm-hmm.
She loved to write, she wrote poetry, and she loved to write, and she loved to read and to know things. And we got our love of reading from her. And when I was 5 years old, the woman who was teaching at our place wanted, for some reason, she wanted to leave and go someplace early and wanted to be out of school. And my mother finished her last month of school for her. And I was 5 years old, and she took me with her. Now, that was the only time I was ever in school. And I was never a very well child. I had a cold from October till June. And Mama said I simply couldn't trace through the mud and sit in a cold room. The other children all went to school. My older sister graduated from Marshall. And my next brother, they went to Essex, went to Mark Harvey at Barbersville and to Huntington grade school. But he hated school, and he never, every time the spring came, he got homesick and came home to farm. And my next sister went to school in Portsmouth, high school in Portsmouth. But for some reason, I used to tell her she didn't think it was worthwhile educating me. I wasn't going to amount to anything anyhow. And so then I never, as I say, we had lessons at home. And she mapped out our lessons. But I don't recommend it, because you get a very one-sided education that way. Mathematics was just an enigma to me, and so and English. I love history and geography, and it was very good in math. But, and physiology, all those sort of things, I love. But I did arithmetic was terrible. And then when I was a widow, I went to school in Portsmouth and took a business education and came up here, and that was the only time I ever had any schooling.
What kind of work did your father do? He was
farming? Yes, he farmed. His father and mother moved to the farm down there in 1866. He was 2 years old, and he lived and died there, and he was 75. And the farm was in our... My great-grandfather bought it in 1848, and my mother sold it about 1858. He had it about 100 years.
What do you remember particularly about your father as you were growing up? Is there anything that stands out?
I think he was one of the finest men I ever knew. But he wasn't a Christian. That's the only thing I've ever regretted about him. But he was one of the finest men I ever knew. He was just fair to everybody and kind. And he was looked up to by all his neighbors. Yeah, I mean, if anybody was in, although we were poor as Job's turkey, anybody that needed anything, they came to Papa. And he always, in some manner, would help him. He'd carry him like corn and grain and hay and that sort of stuff. You know, he would carry him indefinitely. I've had men tell me since I came here how Papa helped them by letting them have corn and hay and stuff to feed their stock through the winter. And he was a very kind father. In fact, I loved him. I felt like the roof fell in on me the day he died. And he and my mother were very, very happy. They just depended on each other. And I always ran after him. My oldest brother was 7 years older than I, and he was able to work, and I ran after Papa. And I know my grandmother used to be so horrified. She said, "I heard you went to Portsmouth with your father yesterday, barefooted,
And I said, of course I did. She said, well, don't you know the ladies don't do that play? I was just a little girl. And she said, well, don't ever do it again. She said, I never let my daughters go out. And she didn't. And but Papa didn't mind. I rode all the horses. I went to the field with him and rode the horses back. I was just like a boy. Then, when I was 11 years old, we had another little boy. And but he didn't run after Papa like I did. I was a boy. A big load of solder turning over on me while I was driving the horses, and he put a great big load of solder on a wagon one day, and it turned over with me, dumped me on this, but we were crossing a ditch, you know, and I didn't use good judgment in driving the horses across, and it turned. But it didn't hurt me. My grandmother and grandfather lived just within, you know, sight of each other. And we, if Mama wasn't feeling well or she wanted to go somewhere, she just said, now you go on in and stay with your grandmother. And I was just as welcome as grandmama's. I stayed there just as much as I did at home, nearly. And when Mama was very sick, when I was 4 years old, and they didn't think she was going to live, and they sent me to my grandmother's, and it was just like home. I just remember her putting me to bed every night, saying my prayers, kissing me goodnight, and she taught me to read while I was there out of a primer. We were a very close family.
As you talk, you've kind of done some comparing and contrasting of the old days, so to speak, and now. Do you think times are better or worse than they were?
I think we have potential, wonderful potential in our country now. But the worst thing that's wrong with it is the people.
How so?
They aren't cultivated like they used to be. It isn't anybody's fault, it's just that we're the melting pot, if you know what I mean, of Europe. And we have so many people that are not trustworthy, and they're not, they don't have the integrity that these people did that I knew. In my neighborhood, is the least departure was just looked on with horror. You know, and they were eccentric, very eccentric. Sometimes I said that when I think about some of the people that I knew, they're so eccentric in their manner and all. But they were good people. You know, they were people you could believe, you could trust, and it. Of course, at my age, it appeals to me. My grandmother and grandfather lived in this house, as I say, all their lives. They moved there in 66 with two little boys, and they had five girls after that. And my grandmother had a governess for them in the winter, and in the summer, usually inveigled some painting teacher, some lady that gave painting. Now that painting there is my father's younger sister, and that was a lady that gave them painting lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a number of pictures just like that that people painted. And then they all had music lessons. She would get us music teachers, and they came and stayed all summer and gave all the girls lessons in music. And they all painted, they all sang and played the piano. I don't know, it just seems to me like it was such a different culture. Now you don't know any girls who play the piano. or sing without their doing it for a career or the stage. And then people were just supposed to be broadened and to know things. They read, not trace, but really novels. And my grandmother had a word that she used all the time. She'd read something and she'd say, well, that's not edifying. And edifying, as I comprehend it, means that this would improve you. That's not, well, that was not edifying. I have a picture of my father's where we live. Now this is the, there's a lady painted that, and the picture itself that was taken from is this big. Now that was in 1874, I think, that was painted, and that is my father in the yard and his sisters. And the house faces the river, and that is the back and side of it. And it is just a house exactly like this, as I said, it even smelled musty like this one does. I said that's the reason I bought this one, I think, because it's so musty, it made me think of Mother's home. We lived there for many years.
That's a delightful painting.
I love that house. It burned recently.
You mentioned times of austerity when you were talking. How did you get through the Depression?
I guess I didn't know the difference. We never did have any money. Living on the farm, it was a depression, but not much. We had everything but money. We had plenty of food. All the food that anybody would need, we raised our own hogs, had meat, we had beef. My father had beef cattle that he would sell, and we had all sorts of vegetables and fruit. We had a peach orchard, we had an apple orchard, we had raspberries, and everything, every berry you could think of, strawberries and asparagus, but we never had any money. But we always had plenty to read, we had nice things, and books and papers, but we never had any money to spend them. And as I say, I don't think that I ever, during the Depression, let's see, that was, I came up here in 26, and you mean that about 29,
right.
Along there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I didn't know the difference. You know, when I came here to work, I made $15 a week in the bank, and the other day, I was at a family picnic, and this lady said to me, I said, she's a teacher. I said, are you about to retire? She said, yes, I think I will next year. And she said, but I'd hate to give it up. I said, oh, well, you can substitute, as everybody does. She said, oh, they only pay $30 a day now. And I said, and dear me, I came up here to work for $15 a week. But I wasn't paying $25 for a pair of shoes then. And I don't pay it now by now. But that's I always, the way I have done all my life, I never bought anything that I didn't know I couldn't pay for. I never bought clothes and old clothes. I never bought any kitchen appliances till I had to have them. I never bought anything but what I knew exactly where the money was coming from to pay for them. And I have advised that to all of my family, because young people are so reckless now. They have to have everything. And you can't do it only. And you can't pay your bitches. And that way, when I finally, when my husband died, we hadn't saved a great deal, only this house was mine. And I had paid for it years ago. And I have an annuity. the post office and some good salary. I have enough income to live on comfortably. And as I like to tell people, we hear about these poor old people that are so poor and they have, you know, they've suffered so they don't have enough to do anything with. They have to stay at home so closely and all. And I say, well, I never did any other way. If I'm poor, I don't know. And because I never was any other way.
When you bought this house, were you looking for a place along the river? Like
no, I bought it because I had to move and I had no place else. I wouldn't have bought it if I hadn't had to.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in a house in the lower end of town. And a lady came to me and asked me if I would be interested in her house, that she was moving home with her mother. Her mother was old and she had to take care of her.
Mm-hmm.
And would I like her house? And she said the reason that she thought of me, I had no children, and she didn't want her house to be taken care of. So I was very well pleased. It was in a nice, it was on the river here, a couple blocks below here. So I said, I was very well pleased to get it. And we moved. And we had been in the house a few months, and she came to me and said she couldn't live where she was living any longer. She had to have her house back. There were no houses in Greenup, but this house and a terribly run-down little house across the street that fronted on the alley, and a house above here, there just simply were no houses available. And I didn't know exactly what to do. I didn't know anything about building, and my husband didn't either. We were both busy. So this house, Mr. Polk had owned it. Mr. and Miss Polk had both died, and they left the son and daughter here. And they were very good at managing their affairs. And they wanted to sell the house and move in an apartment. They thought it would be better for their situation. So I bought it. And I've been here ever since, and I think I'll stay here as long as I can.
Mm-hmm.
It suits me, it's quiet here, and the house is very comfortable. It has a furnace. Last winter, well, I didn't have any frozen pipes or any discomfort. I was very comfortable all winter.
You've mentioned the 37 flood. Have there been any other times when the river has gone over its bank since then?
I moved here in January in January of 36. And in March it came up to the top step of the porch. And there was a long porch clear across the front of this house.
Mm-hmm.
A nice big porch. I loved it. It was wide and I had a glider, I don't know what all. I had all sorts of stuff out there. And as I say, it came up, and we were frightened to death and carried everything upstairs. But it didn't come in the house. It was in the cellar, and we had to take the furnace unit out.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next year, in Southern Salem, it was 2.5 feet upstairs here. And that's when we had to begin to do all this work on the house. And then from then on, I just couldn't tell you if the pier in here. Well, it once or twice it was up just to the top of the baseboard, and once or twice it was up higher than that, and we tied a skiff in the hall here. You have to leave the window, the doors open, you know, because they swell and you can't get them open, and then you have all kinds of complications. So we would just bring a boat in and tie it there on the skiff post. And by the way, we had to put in new stairs after the 37 flood. And, dear me, I just couldn't tell you all the trouble we've had with that. And each time the unit had to come out of the furnace in the cellar, we had the coal converted to gas.
Mm-hmm.
And we had that taken out. And Sometimes I feel like nobody knows the troubles I'm seeing. When I think about
it. You stayed through it all.
Well, why not? Now there was two or three people who lived on the riverbank. They built new houses and moved out on the hill back here. And in the winter, it was perfectly dreadful getting in and up and down that hill. And now, since the state highway went through, it's worse than ever because the traffic is so bad, you know. And so, as long as we were working here in town, I said I'd just rather be down here in the middle of it than out there where I had to make it in town every day. And of course, I worked 40-some years here, you know. And it's more convenient to live downtown anyway.